Welcome to Inside West Point, Ideas That Impact. I'm Brigadier General Shane Reeves, the Dean of the United States Military Academy at West Point. Through a series of discussions, we will show you a different side of West Point, where we will make even our most complex initiatives accessible to broad audiences and give you an inside view to our cross-disciplinary work, which is being applied throughout the world.
I'm thrilled to have Dr. Enoch Nageli here from the Department of Chemistry and Life Science to talk to us about building renewable energy. So let me tell you about Enoch. Dr. Enoch Nageli is an associate professor and the program director of chemical engineering in the Department of Chemistry and Life Science. He is the principal investigator of an interdisciplinary research group of cadets majoring in chemical engineering, life science, and chemistry. He earned his PhD in chemical engineering from Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio in 2014, where he completed his dissertation on the controlled synthesis, functionalization, and assembly of carbon nanomaterials for novel energy storage and conversion devices through an Air Force Research Lab fellowship at the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Following his doctoral studies, Dr. Nageli worked as a postdoctoral fellow on a large-scale high-energy capacity flow battery project funded by the Department of Energy. He is a member of the American Institute of Chemical Engineers and an officer in their Environment Division. He is also a member of the American Chemical Society and the Electrochemical Society. Dr. Nageli currently serves as a member of the Chemical Engineering Program ABET Accreditation Board, assistant officer in charge for the Cadet American Institute of Chemical Engineers Club, Chemical Engineering Department Academic Counselor, and Assistant Officer Representative for the United States Military Academy men's basketball team. Woo! All right. First, Enoch, I have to say I love how you dove headfirst into the full West Point experience. Thanks for all you do to develop cadets in and out of the classroom. I'm going to ask you a tough question out the gate. What is your favorite part of the West Point experience?
I'd like to start with the ability to do research with cadets and connecting classroom fundamentals to observing them and actually being part of it in the lab.
Yeah. And so what you would call that teaching through research?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk specifically about your research. And again, I want to highlight how much the research that you're doing is connected to the education of the cadets and in the classroom. I think that's what makes it so exciting. But talk to me about what inspired you to conduct this battery research that you're working on. Mm-hmm.
So it was the Air Force experience. Like, I had a Wright-Patterson Air Force Base Fellowship that funded graduate school through a Dayton area graduate school program. So I ended up having exposure to DOD-based research, but it was focused more on materials. And to truly innovate device level, to make more efficient, more lighter, or more even more form factor fitting into like a sleeve or into a smaller footprint, you have to innovate those materials that make up those devices. So that kind of was the exposure I got. And I think the energy side of things came in when I still remember I was a graduate student in grad school where I went to India and to attend a family wedding, a family friend's wedding. And still remember it was in Mumbai at the time where I still remember walking around and it shocked me, the grid infrastructure reliability that city of 18 million or so, about twice the population of New York City, but three times smaller in square footage, where power and energy, it struck me that rolling blackouts are part of the equation. And I remember driving around or walking around and being like, wow, this is amazing. It's still a lot of the energy resources are similar to what we use. Coal and fossil fuels and renewables are one aspect. So then I started digging a little bit more. That same year when I got back from India, Hurricane Sandy hit. And that devastated the East Coast and really impacted the grid and the reliability for power. So going 2 weeks without power in areas of need connected that a little bit more to me about the importance of looking into how can we take the great reliable grid we have where the utility operators are providing that energy whenever on demand, how can we augment it to have either backup power or an ability to peak shave or to essentially meet the demands when the demand is very high, maybe the grid operators can use alternative technologies to peak shave.
When you say peak shave, what does that mean?
So essentially, it would work in a way that when the demand is very high, utility space, you have to meet that demand by increasing generation. And the generation can come from resources such as fossil fuels or natural gas. Like coal and natural gas are the dominant ones. Maybe one way to shave that demand or that peak and surge, you can essentially augment or distribute renewable energy infrastructure to help you support that demand. So you're not trying to really meet that surge in demand with by yourself by adding more fossil fuels. You can use other alternative technologies to help you balance that.
I guess that gets into the battery technology because if I think about it, the benefit of fossil fuels is you can respond to energy demands immediately.
Yes,
with renewables, there is your restraints are wind or solar, or hydro, whatever it might be. And it gets into a storage question. Am I right?
That's exactly right.
So, and that's what you're trying to work on, because that seems like that's the point of failure right now is the ability to store energy, let's say solar energy. I don't know if I'm exactly right, but it's trying to figure out a way to have consistency with renewables that you could basically supplement or maybe even eventually replace the benefits of fossil fuels.
That's where either you're not meeting the demand at the time with the grid infrastructure you have, or is there a way you can use the natural resources around you, like solar and wind? Can you store that with batteries and store it with the intermittency of wind and solar? And if you have a solar farm, when you have light, you can basically have your batteries to store that power. And then at night, you can discharge that battery to provide any reliable power to the
grid. As a result, removing the rolling blackout problem.
Yes, sir.
And so, again, it gets into this battery question. And I guess also into a reliable grid. So you have fossil fuels, you have renewables, which I guess are heavily reliant on battery technology. And then you have nuclear. Where do you see nuclear fitting into that, all that?
What I think that's one of the resources that our grid can definitely use. The dominant resources are still coal and natural gas. And I think nuclear power is still part of the equation. The infrastructure and the support and safety of nuclear, just like any other dispatchable power source, is very important. And I think it's close to 18 to 20% of our power comes from nuclear, which has been changing a lot. But I think that technology is there. And I think we need to be able to be ready to use whatever we need to meet the demands of the grid.
But do you see renewables playing a bigger and bigger part?
Yes.
Assuming you can get the battery problem solved.
I completely agree.
We're all looking at you to get the battery problem solved, right?
I'll be in the lab.
So tell me about the batteries. Like, I know there's, like, what is the problem, I guess, number one, that, like, why? I mean, to me, it's, all right, we have a battery. I get some power through solar, and it gets stored into a battery. I plug the battery into the grid when I need it, but that doesn't seem to be working. Like, what is the issue with the batteries, and what type of batteries are we talking about?
So you have the two different types and categories. You have the stationary power. So stationary batteries, which are large-scale batteries for large power demands. If you want to store a lot of energy, you need larger infrastructure. So stationary power works that way. And then there's the mobile energy, which is similar to like the lithium ion that's in our laptops, that's in your phone, that's in your vehicles, in your EV sector. They're definitely different chemistries to use. Right now, the research ideas or research questions that the energy storage community is looking at is, what are the right chemistries to use? And I think that's where the chemistry side of things, the flow battery, is what we started to look at West Point here.
What's a flow battery?
So imagine the components of a regular battery. You have two electrodes and then a membrane or a separator between the two electrodes. And then you have usually a liquid or a paste that's an electrolyte. And electrolytes have ions and species that can actually transfer electrons to the electrodes. So essentially that's how we power something or provide electricity. But the idea behind a flow battery is taking that same approach, but imagine the liquid electrolyte being in tanks and tanks that are scalable. So if you want to have larger energy density, so you have essentially more energy to store. But the power can scale the same way. So to meet power demands of a large solar infrastructure or wind infrastructure, you want to store a lot more. So you make the tanks larger, but then you can also take the same two electrodes between a separator and connect a bunch of cells.
Are you working on flow batteries?
Yes.
So how's your research working towards making the flow battery that you just described, you know, these big scalable flow batteries possible? And where's the hang up? Like, why can't we do it? What would be an example?
So the rare earth metals that cost as high as like vanadium, which has been the most commercialized flow battery system that exists everywhere now, I think they're vanadium. Resources are precious metals that are not abundant. We don't have a lot of it. And now we have to start innovating at that periodic table level where you look at different elements and use their properties that are more earth abundant, that are safer, that you want a reliable grid with. So that's where the research space is actually going. And working on that here at West Point, we've visited Lockheed Martin Energy recently because they have a contract with Fort Carson, and the Army's supporting building a flow battery at Fort Carson to tie into the solar grid.
The first flow battery farm is being built at Fort Carson right now?
And for installation, energy security, and storage. Because if you're in a geographical area where you have a lot of sun, you have the solar cells or solar farm, you need to be able to store a lot of that. If you're dumping electricity that you're not using from the solar cells, it just makes sense to integrate batteries or energy storage into it. So that's a technology that, you know, the Army is looking at, and it's going to be built at Fort Carson. And it's very exciting. And that's where we come in, and we're doing a lot of the fundamentals with my collaborators at Case Western, looking at building flow batteries, but small scale, like bench tops here, looking at the chemistries, looking at the performance diagnostics. What happens when you change flow rates of that electrolyte? What happens when you change the concentration? What's happening inside the cell when you increase the stack size? So things like performance.
How does this all connect to your work with nanomaterials?
So it's a little bit different because even though they're connected, I would say big batteries and flow batteries still require the same materials. It's still the same chemistry. Nanomaterials were, you know, ever since we have the ability to isolate and synthesize these materials, we can now figure out a way to engineer them into three-dimensional space. So those nanomaterials are still the same.
What makes something a nanomaterial? Like, what is there some sort of size?
Yes, so the Nobel Prize in 2010 was awarded for the first paper that was published in Science in 2004 by University of Manchester team, looking at basically isolating a single layer of carbon atoms. One of the questions is taking what the Nobel Prize experiment was, taking a flake of graphite, which we all can relate to, things you can find everywhere, whether it's your pencil lead that has some form of graphite in. You take graphite, and what happened was they ended up starting by breaking down those big sheets of graphite by using scotch tape, pressing scotch tape on top of graphite, peeling off the scotch tape, and essentially you would see a layer of graphite or chunks of graphite that transferred to the scotch tape. And then you would take that same piece of scotch tape, fold it in half, and open it up again. And so you're continuously breaking down the crystallite sizes, or the size of the crystals that are graphite-based, that are all carbon, into smaller dimensions. And that's a way you can look at it. And the material science community has been looking at this a lot because the Nobel Prize was awarded for graphene, but graphene was probably theoretically written about in papers for a long time.
Can you give me an example? What you mean by like engineering them into a three-dimensional space?
We can make them now, but how do we use them into devices? A big part of my effort when I got here in 2016 was working in that material science, nanomaterials engineering space where we're making graphene in the lab. And one of the questions that popped up is, cadets have the same question when they start in the lab is, how do we use it? It's in a solution and it's very transparent. The solution looks like it's just water. You have a low concentration. And the thing is, like, you want to take those materials, you want to tune the surface chemistry or engineer the chemistry to be able to connect them into three dimensions, because you have nanomaterial that's a single sheet of carbon. It's not even, you know, it's a few nanometers thick, but it's a couple microns in terms of width and dimension.
How long until you and some cadets win the Nobel Prize?
Well, I don't know about that, sir. Well,
I'm putting on a mark on the wall, 2024. Right? So the science fiction, the hopeful, like, well, this is what we're hoping to see in the future with nanomaterials and what that's going to open for us.
So right now we have processors that power everything or that essentially provide information, like your computer, your watch, your phone has processors, and those processors have microchips. And those microchips are made up of things that are billions of transistors that help you transfer current and information. But you want to get smaller. And the dimensions that which the processors are working in, you can't really fit a lot of other things at the large scale. You can start working on nanomaterials to basically be part of that transistor. Imagine a circuit that's a single carbon nanotube, which is essentially a rolled up sheet of graphene or a single sheet of graphene that's a billionth the size of your strand of hair. And you can pack more processors and more computing power into smaller space now because you have the materials to help you reach the current and voltage limits that your processor requires. And another space is, I think, to get lighter batteries and to be able to have, without sacrificing performance and speed, you need to innovate at the electrode level. And the electrode level right now, most of the electrodes, people are surging in looking at carbon paste, which is just essentially like activated carbon or charcoal, things that we know are large chunks of graphite-based materials. But imagine replacing one side of the battery with nanomaterials to reduce the weight even more, because weight distribution is a very important thing for mobile applications. Like one day your vehicle, whether it's an EV vehicle or some autonomous vehicle, you'll be able to have power, distributed power sources that are embedded into the body or the framework of a vehicle that can serve a purpose both for function in terms of like mechanical integration, but also provide power on demand. Or if your materials of a drone or a vehicle are made up of some solar cell materials that can help you charge the battery, that's part of the body of the vehicle.
That's pretty revolutionary right there. This question, tell me exactly what the cadets are doing in this space. And what's your day-to-day like working with the cadets?
Oh, it's awesome. I think that's really connects with problem solving. At the essence, we're solving problems or we're finding more problems to solve. And I think the scientific method is what we're practicing every day. But a day in a lab would be our team, our research group is organized with cadets from all three majors and even outside of chemistry, life science as well. We have an economics major who's a first year right now on the team. So we've been working with making the materials into three dimensions. So if we can synthesize graphene, which we did, that was the first efforts in the lab, make it using a different technique instead of scotch tape, instead of a cadet standing over scotch tape and just peeling it back and forth, which I think would be pretty cool. That was one of the first experiments my PhD advisor mentioned. Hey, you should try the scotch tape technique, which I didn't know that could probably take a long time. And getting that graphite to be a single layer, I realized right away it was a teaching.
How do you know the graphite's in a single layer? Well, how do you know when you're done?
That's the thing. You can't see it.
Yeah.
And you have to do some characterization and using materials characterization or microscopy to look at where you can look at things at a nano dimension.
Or class is over and you're like, that's good.
Yes, sir.
You fit the single layer.
So we've been working on a technique that you can chemically oxidize it. So imagine you start with graphite, but you're using strong acids to basically break apart those graphite layers between the graphite sheets. It's like a textbook that you have a bunch of pages, but imagine introducing things between pages like bookmarks, and those bookmarks are what separates those sheets. And over time with energy, which we use like in high temperature, you can break apart those sheets in solution. But the toughest challenge with that textbook of opening it up with bookmarks, which are functional groups, is the textbooks like to close. Mm-hmm. And as we know, we can't leave it open forever. And that energy between those sheets is so high that they tend to restack. So what we do is we introduce things like plastics, like polymers, or other metals to tune the properties of individual graphene sheets. And the first couple of years as a faculty member, working with Colonel Burpo and a lot of junior faculty and senior faculty in chemistry life science, we're able to figure out and study what kind of chemistry can we introduce into these materials that can continually keep them at the nanoscale. Whether it's in solution, they're physically not restacking to lose surface area, to lose the properties.
How new is this? Like this, what you're discussing, this nanotechnology research that you're doing in the lab, and you're doing it with cadets. And to, sure, yeah. to anyone who's listening to this, who's, you know, went to West Point, you know, 25, 30 years ago, I mean, this is a complete change in how we do things. And so the first question is like, how new is this ability to do research on nanotechnology? And then further, how do you see this complementing and supplementing cadet education to help them be critical thinkers?
Oh, it's the novelty of the research is probably where in the last 20 years we've been, as a scientific community, we've been advancing the ball forward, whether it's small iteration of finding new materials or finding new chemistry or just using them in a system. And I think collectively that's what the academic space and the national lab space is looking at. But from a West Point perspective, we've, you know, looked at these materials since probably around 2016 when I got here, integrating these carbon nanomaterials into a normal lab experiment and then studying their properties. Cadets bring that fresh look. They seek that understanding even to connect the classroom fundamentals to the lab. And I think one of the ways we work together on this is figuring out what problems to solve. And I think that's where it's a challenging space where your boundary conditions open up completely. Like it's, you can come up with a local solution, but you have to think about the next problem because it's not really solving the bigger picture. It's a small solution to a bigger problem.
And that translates very well into expecting cadets to be officers who can solve complex problems or spot issues and try to figure out solutions to those issues. How do you see the technology or the work that you're doing in the lab translating and being applied in some practical or operational way?
Oh, that's one of the reasons why coming here, the end user is not just the scientific innovation, but also is how can it support the Army? And that's where working with collaborators at Picatinny Arsenal, part of the DEVCOM Armament Center, we're able to study, you know, and innovate these batteries that the cadets are working on. It serves a purpose because they might be going into munitions. Mm. And looking at materials maybe could be one way that we can solve the bigger picture, but we can look at the different options that one day when we want to innovate and create or study the next power device, whether it's for munitions, for geo-tracking, or processors onto munitions, you need power. You need power to make things happen. And that's what we can bring that to the application space, because everything we do is not only training the future generation of officers, they're going to be critical problem solvers, but they're going to be able to understand the technology and the end user at the same time to be able to come up with a new battery or new capacitor that could work will be even more meaningful for the cadets before they commission. Maybe it's tested in one single railgun, or maybe it's tested in a air gun. But at least we know that there's an end user in mind. But not only does it support the Army, but overall you're advancing the ball in nanomaterials and the options of the technology going forward.
Can you talk specifically about the connection to, you mentioned that you're doing work on munitions.
Yes, sir.
Like what exactly are you doing with munitions?
So we're looking at thermal batteries and thermal capacitors. I've been working with Dr. D. Benedetto as part of the fuse division and the power team at DEVCOM AC at Picatinny, and basically translating the work we're doing here into some of the device work that we can develop at Picatinny to go test in the next air gun or test to see if it meets the power demands for munitions. It all started with the multidisciplinary team in CLS with civilian universities, and junior officers were a big part of it. Major Casper Yee and Major Jeff Chin, who are first-time rotators, taught at West Point. They're both grads. They're both chemical engineers. And they worked on research for 3 years while they're here in that nanomaterial space. And what we're able to do is, like, figure out a way to take graphene, together with other nanomaterials, how do we make it into a three-dimensional film? And one of the collaborative things that we did was with Cornell University, with Professor Ju at Cornell, who was Major Yi's research advisor. We established a electro-spraying machine that can be built by taking materials, because it looks like you have nanomaterials, it looks like pixie dust, right? You can't really do anything with pixie dust. I mean, it sounds great, but putting them back into solution, you want to be able to make films or make electrodes. So one way that Major Yi and the team of cadets that worked on it for probably a year and a half now, and to be able to electro-spray these materials onto a electrode, and that electrode went directly into a conventional coin cell, which is like a similar, like a watch battery here, that cadets were able to take the electrode, electro-spray some nanomaterials into 3D, and then put it into a watch battery cell and cycle the battery. And that's the kind of where we're at now in terms of like, take these results and take this research and translating it to a co-authored publication, first-time rotators with senior faculty and also DOD S&T as well as civilian schools, and making research the hub at which innovation can happen. And that same research is what's getting translated at Picatinny Arsenal right now, and taking the materials we make in our spraying technique and bringing that into power devices that we can test.
Let me ask you one more technical question. How long until you would think we'd have the battery technology to be able to harness the energy that comes from renewables to be able to supplement the surges that we talked about in the grid?
I think we're there.
You do?
I think we do. There's a lot of innovation in the last 10 years. Flow battery space, it's like everyone who is working on fuel cells using hydrogen as fuel also has started working in the flow battery community. Things we learned from fuel cells, which have been around for a while, has translated a lot in advanced flow batteries. And my research advisor, my postdoc research advisor, Professor Robert Savinel, is one of those faculty who've invested in the all-iron flow battery, which I did my postdoc with. There's the technologies there, and there are examples of grid-level energy storage systems all around the world. The chemistries are different all around. There's startup space and companies that are looking at different chemistries, like Lockheed Martin Energy has their own chemistry. We've got other commercialized technologies like using vanadium ion, which is the most conventional flow battery technology. But there's a lot of different options that I think the advancement in the renewable energy space for flow battery installation energy security has advanced a lot. And I think for our true installation energy security, we should be able to have backup power. And whether it's storing the energy that we have now in a remote or offsite or even a forward operating base or anywhere like an installation like West Point, we should be able to have our mission and continue to conclude with our mission, and no matter what the energy demands are.
So what inspired you to come to West Point?
Well, long story short, I submitted an abstract to this future faculty poster session. It was in Salt Lake City, Utah in 2015. And the American Institute of Chemical Engineering Conference was held there. And I'll remember to this day, one of the group of faculty that visited my poster was then the program director for chemical engineering at the time, Colonel Jeff Bull, and the senior faculty member in chemical engineering, Dr. Andy Biaglo, who's a professor of chemical engineering. Both came over to my poster, sent some emails out thanking everyone who exchanged contact information. And that was one of the emails I received back, was Dr. Biaglo emailing me and encouraging me to apply to a USA Jobs ad. And I'll still remember it said instructor/assistant professor. And it was an academic position. And this is pre-tenured system, official tenure system. So you could be a non-renewable term employee and kind of extend from there. But it just made sense for me to submit an application, especially because one thing I noticed that they required a teaching statement. And I remember thinking, going through the process where I was looking at other academic schools, the teaching statement was what I was told and mentored at Case Western and throughout my time of people searching for faculty positions, focus on the research statement when you submit. But I kind of spent time on both.
Our primary mission is to educate, train, inspire the core cadets And teaching the cadets is the focus of the academic program. I mean, it's a teaching institution, yet I think you found that the research can complement it. But why did teaching attract you?
As an engineering major, I always wanted to see, where am I going to see this in the real world? And I think that's where that culture of teaching through research, which we do in chemistry, life science, really drew me in, because I think that's where I had an opportunity to connect classroom fundamentals and then do the scientific method, which we've done since we're kids. You make an observation, you run mole trials on it, and then figure out how that data fits. And that's where I thought it would draw in more cadets, where you have these courses that at times could seem like isolated experiences, but I think doing multidisciplinary research can really connect all those classes to a application or to a greater picture.
We said it earlier, we're a teaching institution, but we teach through research. And sure. I think it's one of the things that makes West Point so much fun for a faculty member, is that connection to the cadets and that energy that comes in the classroom. How does that inform the research that you do when you are in the classroom with cadets?
Looking back and being back in general chemistry, teaching plebes or freshmen, general chemistry, really, everything we do in the lab goes back to fundamentals. So a freshman in college can come and start research right away with the exposure to the fundamentals in the classroom. But I think anything we're doing in the lab, anything in our group, we're doing it with the fundamentals in mind. I thought that's what makes it translatable, where you can connect every single experiment to making observations after an experiment's done, but then you can always go back to the periodic table and what you observed in your general chemistry course. And then I think throughout their careers, progression through either chemical engineers, life scientists, or chemistry majors, you can connect more in-depth fundamentals, have time to dig in, and then solve more complex problems throughout the years.
So we're going to come back to the periodic table, because I know you love it. Right? So you clearly have an immense passion for research. Why?
Wow. I was really motivated by my family. And I think a big part of it is, like, what else is there if we're not truly working on the next problem? And I think that's what really motivates me, whether it's in the classroom. How do we innovate in the classroom to come up with new problems, new design concepts for cadets to study? But also that applies in research, and I think I'm like naturally drawn to that. It could be that I was probably taking things apart when I was a kid, when I wasn't supposed to probably, but I think that kind of translated into this curiosity. And I think that's where the curiosity really connected with, research connects with that curiosity that I have.
When we teach cadets through research, what are you trying to, obviously trying to get answers or try to uncover different problems that will drive more research, but what's the secondary benefit you think for them?
I think it really develops their ability to adapt regardless of climate and resources. Adapt and really come up with local solutions on the fly, and to innovate when you have a lack of resources or a lack of technology. Because I think when you're investing in education now, your investment is in the individual, and we work on developing character. And I think the proficiency to be able to solve problems is also a skill set that we have to be able to continually adapt and solve problems when maybe resources are limited. Maybe you're in an environment that really doesn't dictate the same problem solving that everyone else has been looking at. So I think this space that research really offers is giving cadets exposure to how do we do that with the resources we have.
And I like, when I think about it, what you've talked about here, it's iterative. Innovation is iterative. It's not you're going to solve it right out the gate. It requires a level of humbleness to recognize that maybe I don't know everything. It also requires teamwork. You kept talking about the research team, and I like the fact on that focus on teamwork. And then I think what you're really getting at is just helping them to become critical thinkers,
right?
Being able to think broadly, think differently. And I love your point about you might not have a completely sanitized or a perfect place with all the resources you need, you might have to adjust on the fly. So it creates a level of flexibility. And I think that's the benefit. When you just described it, as you were saying, I'm like, yeah, that's pragmatically, I see so much about creating adaptive young officers who the way they think. I also think there's the level of, you can't be risk adverse when you do this. Like, you have to expect to either fail or hit a roadblock and be okay with that.
I always joke around about the dissertation time and dark times for a lot of us. And you only write a little bit about that one couple things that worked. But then a lot of it is problem solving about things, why things didn't work. And I think one of the ways we reach cadets is in the lab, we're doing technologically advancing the ball for research, but we're also spending more contact time in the lab than I do in the classroom. It's a small group of cadets that one-on-one where we can talk about anything, and whether it's the character development side of things, but also I really think that character development happens with research because there are times where nothing works.
Yeah.
And those things don't work for a reason. And there's nothing better than more character development than something so complex that you can't see or pick up and use that just happens. And there's something that happened that shouldn't have happened based on your prediction or observation. But you go back and problem solve and you find out that there's different pathways that you can take. You can go down essentially a pathway where it leads to more problems, but those problems will lead to some local solution that really can help you advance. So you're essentially developing character at the same time because you're solving problems for things that haven't been done before.
You are clearly completely inculcated in the West Point environment because you just said, like, when something goes wrong or a cadet's challenge or they fail, it's like, hey, it's building character. Don't worry about it. That's the perfect line right there. Okay, I have some rapid fire questions.
Yes, sir. I don't know if I'm ready, but
we'll see. All right, here you go. What's the most challenging course you teach?
So I would probably say Chemical Engineering Laboratory, CH-459.
Do you have a pocket protector?
I need to get one, sir.
How many copies of the periodic table do you have up around your house?
Well, it's interesting you say that. We have science-themed books for our son.
Yeah.
And whenever it's my turn to read, I'd like to, in the beginning, especially when he was an infant, I brought out the periodic table.
You know he's not going to play in the NBA if you do that. What's the hardest class you ever took?
Ooh. Chemical Engineering Statistical Thermodynamics in graduate school.
That sounds terrible. That sounds absolutely terrible.
Stat mechanics was definitely a lot of character development.
Yeah, there's some character development.
Yes, sir.
Okay, you have 30 seconds to give a sales pitch to a future officer to major in chemical engineering. What is it?
It's chemical engineering is a field of specialty that combines math and science, math, chemistry, and physics to understand how processes work when you're making food, when you're coming up with energy technologies, or simple household things like clothes. What you want to do is you want to work on innovating using math and combining math and science to be able to solve processes that help you make things cheaper, maybe things more efficient, and also things more accessible.
Good. All right. So thanks for joining us, Enoch. Be sure to tune in to the Inside West Point Ideas That Impact podcast next month. Remember, you can find this podcast, as well as the other podcasts, journals, and books hosted or published by the West Point Press at westpointpress.com. Until next time.